Welcome to Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone and the Libertarian Institute. Today I am joined by Carlin Borisenko. She is the author of Actively Unwoke, the ultimate guide for fighting back against the woke insanity in your life. She is also a professional rabble rouser and Libertarian Party New Hampshire delegate, part of the hashtag Reno Reset. She's also a candidate for governor of New Hampshire, calling out BS on both sides. Carlin, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm really happy to be here, Keith. Thank you for having me.
Can you walk me through your ideological process of being in the Democratic Party and then coming over to the Libertarian side?
Yeah. So this is a little bit of a long story, but what I want to start by saying is that throughout this entire process, my values have never really changed. My ideology has never really changed. Listen, I became a Democrat in the 90s, right? And in the 90s, you know, the reason I became a Democrat was essentially that, to be honest, I hated Republicans. I hated Republicans. Republicans were trying to censor everything. They were trying to tell me what speech I couldn't say, what art I couldn't look at, what video games I couldn't play, what music I couldn't listen to. And being sort of a rebellious child, and of course, that's kind of followed through the rest of my life, I suppose, I didn't like that too much. And so I went to the Democratic Party, and really, I was like a three-issue Democrat. My first issue was I was extremely anti-war. So I was in college when George W. Bush got elected. I was in college when we went into Afghanistan and Iraq. I was one of those people who was actually protesting at the anti-war protests on the Boston Common, you know, all the time during those wars. So I was extremely anti-war, and I was, you know, not in favor of what W was doing at the time. I'm also a free speech absolutist. I mean, I remember back to when I was a teenager, I really thought that I was going to go to law school and become a First Amendment lawyer so I could go work for the ACLU and defend free speech and all of that good stuff. And I am also, I am also very much in favor of keeping religion separated from the government. I really do not like it when people with very conservative and fundamentalist Christian, specifically religious values, try to force those values on everyone else, try to legislate those values. That's not to say I necessarily have a problem with Christians or like worship whatever you want. I don't care. I just don't want to be forced to live by your values. And so those were really my big three issues that that led me to the Democratic Party in the first place. And so when I was in college, when W was in office, this was very, very simple for me. I was against everything that that man stood for, period. And then Obama got elected. And I remember specifically the night that Obama got elected, I was at my best friend's house at the time. And it was like a huge sigh of relief came over me, like, oh, it's over now. And when that happened, I shut my brain off to politics. And it wasn't as though my values changed at all. They didn't change. I was just like, I don't have to worry about this anymore. The Democrats have got it under control. I can focus on my career was very important to me. Relationships that I had were very important to me. I started a marriage in that time frame. And I started a business in that time frame. I was actively working on growing a business. And then something odd happened. Social justice came and took over my knitting community. Now, knitting is one of the things that I do just to relax and to have fun and to enjoy myself. Like, it's a hobby. It's a hobby like everyone has hobbies. But my hobby got taken over by radical progressive leftists who are all of a sudden running around canceling everyone and telling everyone what they could and couldn't say. And as I was watching this happen, it dawned on me that I was politically aligned with these people. And that did not sit well for me. Remember, like, I'm a free speech absolutist. It does not sit well with me when you're telling people what they can't say and what they can't think about and things like that. And even if I disagree with people, because I literally cried when Donald Trump got elected. Like, I was one of those people. I cried. But I also never hated him as much as most of the Democrats did. When he got elected, again, I kind of shut my brain off. Literally the week after Trump got elected, I went off to Peru to do ayahuasca in the jungle for like 10 days. And so, like, I was chill with the whole situation. I'm like, this is not ideal, but we're going to survive this. We have survived bad presidents before. We will survive bad presidents again. And in the course of the intervening years, combined with the knitting community going crazy, I just watched all of my friends go crazy, too. And at some point, I started saying, what the heck is going on? Like, why can't people even just have conversations with each other anymore? I didn't understand. And so I started around mid-2019, I think, started challenging myself to listen to points of view that I thought I would disagree with. So I proactively sought out like the worst conservative influencers on the internet, like Ben Shapiro and Milo Yiannopoulos and all of these like really people that I thought were just like awful human beings. And it turns out that they weren't really awful human beings. Okay, Milo says some crazy stuff. He does. But he's mostly doing it for the purpose of saying crazy stuff. And I understand that now. Ben Shapiro is your run-of-the-mill conservative. Like, he's not Satan. He doesn't say anything that's crazy. And so I went through this journey of proactively watching these people that I thought I would disagree with, finding out that they weren't as evil as I thought they were. And it happened to lead me to going to a Trump rally the night before the New Hampshire primary in 2020 as someone who had been a Democrat for 20 years. And at that Trump rally, everyone was really nice to me. They were really welcoming, even when they found out I was a Democrat, which was a really big shift because 2 days prior to the Trump rally, I had actually been at a Democrat rally in exactly the same place. And everyone was mean. Everyone was angry. Everyone was just having a horrible time. And I was like, what is going on? Like, it really seemed to me like the Democrats were the ones that were miserable and the conservatives for the faults that I think they have. And I certainly don't agree with them on everything. They were the ones that were just like welcoming and they were really nice to hang out with. And so I wrote an article about this experience and I put it up on Medium, not thinking anyone would ever read it. And then it went really viral in conservative circles, like 3 million people read it. Trump Jr. tweeted it out. All the Fox News hosts tweeted it out. And all of a sudden, I was like this conservative darling for like a month and a half. I was like the one Democrat that they got to come over to their team, even though I was never really a Republican or a conservative. I ended up spending the majority of 2020 actually touring around the country with the Walkaway campaign, which Walkaway is a campaign of former Democrats who kind of speak out against all of the crazy nonsense that the Democrats were doing. We were focusing on doing rallies in blue cities all over the country to protest against the mandates and against the lockdowns. Because again, like I'm in favor of choice. I don't think anyone should be forced to stop working if they don't want to. I don't think that anyone should be forced to put medicine in their body that they don't specifically consent to. And that was exactly what those rallies were about. And, you know, midway through this, I'm going to be honest, I kind of thought the Libertarian Party sucked. Because I was obviously going through what some people would characterize as a political evolution, even though I never felt that my values changed. But I mean, people would tell me all the time when they asked me about my values, and I would tell them exactly what I told you. And they would say, Carlin, you're not a conservative, you're a libertarian. And I would say, okay, well, the Libertarian Party sucks. So they're not really an option right now. Because I wasn't, you know, I was focused in this one world. I wasn't looking outside of it. And then when Joe Jorgensen sent out the Black Lives Matter tweet, that just kind of sealed the deal for me because there's literally a video of me viral on the internet getting chased by a mob of Black Lives Matter people. And so I was like, nope, that's not going to work out. The libertarian like philosophy to me always sounded good. But in terms of like the politics of it, I was like, nope. And again, just turned my head off to it. And then after the election, I just saw things kind of going south on the political right. And I was like, you know, after January 6th, certainly, but definitely after Biden got elected, I started seeing conservatives in the political right, quite frankly, turn into the woke left. And they were trying to censor speech and they were trying to cancel people. And even right now, I've been arguing for half the day on Twitter with people who want to force their religious values onto other people. And I'm like, have we learned nothing? And so I guess like my political and you know, and in that time frame, I ended up getting involved with the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire. I ended up, I'm on their communications committee. I'm on the politics committee. I ended up just getting involved with the Free State movement and everything that's going on in New Hampshire. And I really, to be quite frank, found my home in that movement. And it was very different than what I perceived it as in 2020 when I was only basically looking at the Libertarian Party Twitter account, right? And we're going to talk about some of the drama today with the Libertarian Party, which I'm really looking forward to. But, you know, I found my place there. But I think, you know, the biggest point I would make is that my values haven't actually really changed. I think for me, my journey was more about identifying what groups actually believed in the values. And the woke left, the Democratic Party, does not believe in my values. I thought for like half a second that maybe Republicans and conservatives believed in my values. And I do legitimately think that some of them do. But most of them do not. They talk about free speech, but what they mean is free speech for them. Or they talk about freedom of religion, but what they mean is freedom of religion for them. They don't mean it for everyone else. And so the place that I've found that best fits the values that I've held dear all of my life is the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire and the Mises Caucus. And that's where I ended up.
What is the thesis of your book, Actively Unwoke, The Ultimate Guide for Fighting Back Against the Woke Insanity in Your Life?
You know, I wouldn't really say my book has a thesis, to be honest. I actually wrote my book to be more of a practical guidebook because, yeah, I am deeply, you know, is I have made, you know, kind of you know, ragging on the conservative right into an art form. Let's just be honest. Like, I have so many problems with them. However, I do actually believe that the woke left and the Democratic Party and the progressives, they're much more dangerous to this country. Precisely because they control every major institution. They control the schools, they control the government, they control the media, they control Hollywood, they control business, they control every major institution in this country. So while I don't fundamentally believe that the Democrats are any different functionally than the Republicans, I think they're two sides of the same coin. The fact of the matter is that one of those sides has political power currently and one of those sides does not. And so the whole premise of my book, Actively Unwoke, is about how do we start to fight back and start to regain control in some of these institutions that we've lost. How do we essentially remove authoritarianism from power? And so there have been many books written about the rise of this, you know, critical theory, critical race theory ideology. You know, you look at something like Cynical Theories by James Lindsay and his newest book, Race Marxism. These are amazing books that will talk about the academic rise. I would say that those are books with more of a thesis statement. What I wrote my book for was to be able to, number one, break down the woke left ideology in plain, simple English. I don't talk about the academic literature. I literally say, here is what they mean when they say microaggression. Here is what they mean when they say unconscious bias. Here is what they mean by the term racism. Here is how they have changed the meaning of the term racism. What I'm trying to do is just explain to average people what is going on, because what the woke left is doing is they're manipulating language as their greatest weapon, and they're doing this precisely to try to confuse people about what is actually going on. So I put it in the simplest terms as I could. The second part of the book are case studies of real people who have stepped up and fought back in the real world. I have a chapter about fighting back in schools. I have a chapter about fighting back in the workplace when you have to do diversity training. I've got a chapter about fighting back in government, trying to pass laws that will throw sand in the gears, that will restrict the power of the state to enforce these ideologies on the average person. And I've got a chapter on fighting back in the culture war, because I do ultimately think that if we're going to turn back the culture revolution that I do believe is underway in this country, very similar to what happened in Mao's China, I do think ultimately it is about creating culture and creating a new culture of art and music and literature and movies and TV shows that present a very different side, that present the liberty point of view rather than the authoritarian view that is kind of embedded in everything we see at this point. And then a couple chapters at the end of the book, I have a chapter about what to do if you're canceled, because I feel like I've been canceled like, you know, half a dozen times in the last 2 years. It's a perfectly survivable thing, but it's the thing that most people are afraid of. So I gave you some tips about that, and also taking care of yourself, self-care strategies when you're fighting back against the woke. So I did write it to be a highly practical guide that everyone can use in their real lives.
So, of course, I can already hear the criticism. So we have this woman who's a Democrat, but she's still sort of has this white allegiance. Once we start fighting against racism and systematic oppression, then she leaves us and writes a book on how bad it is to help minorities. What do you say to that criticism? Assume you're talking to someone who literally does not know. You and I were Obama supporters. We literally had never heard the alternative to, you know, what's wrong with helping the poor for welfare programs? What's wrong with helping Blacks, Hispanics, etc., when it comes to being woke and embracing a philosophy of inclusion?
Yeah, what I would say to those people is critical race theory is not about white people at all. In fact, I have been one of very few people that has been that have been publicly pushing back on this conservative narrative that did come from Fox News that critical race theory is anti-white. I hate that term. I refuse to use it. I actually have banned the use of that term on my YouTube channel because I will not tolerate it. Because the fact is that critical race theory is not anti-white. It is anti-everyone. And I actually think some of the most detrimental things about critical race theory don't even apply to white people. In fact, if we're going to be brass tacks about it, critical race theory says that white people are the most powerful people in society. It literally says that. It's a theory that says white people are at the top of the heap. Well, that actually sounds, I mean, they're using it in a derogatory way, but if I have to choose between being the most powerful person in society and the least powerful person in society, I'm probably going to choose being the most powerful person. And how does this impact people who are not white? Well, if white people are perceived to be the most powerful people in society, that literally tells us that critical race theory thinks that black people can't do the most basic of things without the permission of white people. And I think that that is incredibly racist. I think it is incredibly racist to teach young black children in schools that they cannot be successful in the world unless white people stand aside and allow them to be successful. That is incredibly racist. That is dehumanizing. That is taking away all their individual agency. So my issue with what is going on with the woke left has nothing to do with the fact the idea that I don't want to help minorities is ridiculous. And I'll tell you, this is one of the strategies that I've actually thrown out to woke leftists. I've said, okay, you guys want to talk about equity. So there is a big difference between the ideas of equity and equality when it comes to the woke left. Equality is what most of us have been raised with, the idea that we all show up and we all have an equal chance to at least try ourselves and get access to an opportunity, right? This is what Martin Luther King preached when he says, I want people to judge my children by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. That's what equality is. I am 100% on board with equality. The idea of equity is about equal outcomes. We all end in the same place. And what Ibram X. Kendi, who is the author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, said is the best way to fight discrimination in the past is with discrimination in the present. Mm-hmm. They are literally arguing to discriminate in our present time to account for things that have happened in the past. But let's just play this idea of equity out for a second. Let's say, okay, we've all decided that equity is the most perfect thing. Why aren't we putting an entrepreneurship program in every inner city high school in the country to help young black people who are the disproportionate people who attend inner city high schools in the country? Why aren't we putting an entrepreneurship program in every inner city high school to help black people learn at an early age how to grow a business, how to grow wealth, how to manage and scale a business so that they can create as much success in the world as they want to? I have thrown this idea out to the woke left on multiple occasions. This idea checks all of their equity boxes. It's focused on African Americans. It leads us all to equal outcomes because you're teaching, you're segregating people out by race, and you're saying, I'm going to focus on teaching people with the darkest skin color how to create businesses and be successful. This is something I'm only giving to them, not to white people. The woke left won't touch it because they don't actually want these outcomes. They don't want these populations to be successful. I'll give you another example. Ibram X. Kendi did a speech in Wisconsin a couple months ago where he was asked about, are vaccine mandates systemically racist? Because we know, and especially in New York, we know that African Americans were vaccinated at a much lower rate than white New Yorkers, right? And so Ibram X. Kendi, who has said that racism is all about racial disparities and outcomes. If there is a racial disparity in an outcome, then racism is the cause of that disparity. Ibram X. Kendi himself would not admit that that means that vaccine mandates are racist, even though they do disproportionately impact Black people. And so this is all just a game for the woke left. And what I tell people all the time is that critical race theory actually has nothing to do with race at all. I know that seems counterintuitive, but it really doesn't. Race is just the weapon that they are using to divide us. And what they're doing when they keep us divided and they keep us bickering with each other is they're gaining more power. They're gaining more political power, and they're using that political power to oppress literally anyone who does not agree with them.
They won't even give blacks the freedom to choose where their tax dollars go for which schools they want to send their kids to. So it's not even like, well, we want them to be taxed billions of dollars more to support our stuff. We go, we'll leave the taxes the way they are. Just let the kids go wherever the parents would like. Can we introduce some competition? And they won't even have that. We're actually called racist for opposing something like that. Of course, I've tried to get Ibram X. Kendi so many times. I go, just please tell me, men are 50% of the population and 95% of police killings. Is that sexism? Can we at least see that disparities do not equal oppression? Because men also commit, like, what, 95% of the crime? It's something like that. Or they're more likely to resist the cops. That's not to justify it, but that's an alternative explanation than oppression. I mean, so much of this is ridiculous. The one thing, the reason why I'm tempted to say it's anti-white to sort of vilify the majority population is because if they are negatively generalizing, it's almost always in the direction of that group. Like that, it will certainly seem like they'll say white versus black incomes are different. I have not heard them say Asian incomes are much higher than black, so we have Asian supremacy, or black Americans have higher incomes than black Haitians. I do get the sense that things like slavery, they uniquely pin on whites. Colonialism, they uniquely pin on whites. Is there something I'm missing there?
Yes, there are several things that you're missing there. So they actually literally have said that Asians are white. They actually are literally right now categorizing Asians in the same category as white people. They do this when it suits them. Asians are the most interesting part of the woke hierarchy. The progressives call this the progressive stack. I call it the woke oppression hierarchy, where they basically have a hierarchy of people that, blacks are always at the top of the hierarchy. Generally speaking, you're going to have Native Americans, indigenous people. Generally speaking, you're going to have Hispanics after that. Generally speaking, you're going to have Asians after that, Jews after that, whites after that. But Asians are weird because Asians can vault up to the top of the oppression hierarchy very quickly, or they can be put down at the bottom. I'll give you an instance of when they were at the top of the oppression hierarchy. It was when the whole Black Lives Matter riots were starting to die down, but we had this one guy in Atlanta that went in and shot up a bunch of Asian massage parlors, not because he was against Asians, but because he was a sex addict. And they tried to paint this as an anti-Asian hate crime. Well, now it is true that that there has been an increase in Asian American hate crime or hate crimes targeted towards Asian Americans. Do you know who the primary perpetrator of those crimes are?
Yes, but we'll have to make this an Odyssey exclusive if you say.
It is not white people. It is not white people. And so, Asians are considered oppressed when it suits them. They're not considered oppressed when it doesn't suit them. I'll give you an example of how you're wrong. Harvard actively discriminates against Asian Americans in their admissions process. In fact, there is a case going against the Supreme Court in which Harvard is arguing that they should be able to hold Asian Americans to different admission standards than everyone else, because Asians typically outperform everyone else when it comes to standardized tests, academics, that sort of thing. I'll also give you another example with African Americans. Critical race theory says that African Americans cannot go to the DMV and get a driver's license. Critical race theory says that African Americans can't work hard. It says that they can't tell time, that they can't keep a schedule. I'm not making that up. That was literally a display in the African American History Museum in Washington, D.C. That was literally what it said. And so to say that critical race theory only looks down on white people is just simply not true. It is racist against everyone. It is just racist in different ways.
There is a great quote from a 1986 book written by Thomas Sowell, Civil Rights Rhetoric and Reality. Mm-hmm. So here's just a little intro for people who are not familiar with the actual academic literature in this area. But the number of blacks in professional, technical, and other high-level occupations more than doubled in the decade preceding the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In other occupations, gains by blacks were greater during the 1940s than when there was practically no civil rights legislation compared to the 1950s. In various skilled trades, the income of blacks relative to whites more than doubled between 1936 and 1950. Affirmative action hiring pressures made it costly to have no minority employees, but continuing affirmative action pressures at promotion and discharge phases also makes it costly to have minority employees who do not work out well. The net effect is to increase the demand for highly qualified minority employees while decreasing the demand for less qualified minority employees or for those without a sufficient track record to reassure employers. So, least it be said that we're doing this at the expense of minorities. We have all the data and philosophy to understand that this is not one group benefiting at the expense of another when it comes to racial categories. It's a few progressives and the neocons and the big government advocates benefiting at the expense of all the races. So certainly, I love the thesis of your book, certainly modernizing Sowell's findings in the 1980s. Anything else you have on this? Or do you want to get into the concept of how equality of outcome is undefinable and unachievable. And that's why it's like the perfect thing for tyrants, because it will always give them an excuse in the future, because there's always going to be inequality of outcome.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. Let's talk about that. You know, I talk about the short story, Harrison Bergeron, with my locals community all the time. I mean, Harrison Bergeron is just like, there's a really crappy TV movie like made about it. Well, it's actually, I thought it was a good TV movie. But like, if you look on YouTube, there's a crappy 90s TV movie made about this. And it's basically about like what a society looks like when it's built on equity, where everyone has to have an equal outcome. And what happens is you end up dumbing down the truly exceptional. In a society built on equity, no one is allowed to be exceptional. No one is allowed to be a genius in one specific thing. They have to be brought down to be mediocre. And I think back again, I equate everything lately back to the 90s. I feel like we need to bring the 90s back. The 90s were awesome. It had the best music. I don't care what the 70s say. The 90s had way better music than the 70s. And, you know, I think about in the 90s, when the people who were glorified were the people who were breaking outside of the mold, who were doing the exceptional thing, who were doing the creative thing. You think about bands like Rage Against the Machine. Rage Against the Machine, literally today, is raging for the machine. I mean, it is an astonishing... The drummer of Offspring, one of the great punk bands from the... Well, I mean, relative to other punk... Like, the great mainstream punk bands in the 90s. There were many better punk bands, but, like, they were the mainstream ones, right? So, what, like, the drummer of Offspring literally got kicked out of the band for not being vaccinated. Like, it is absolutely amazing to me to watch what happened to the counterculture in the 90s, actively becoming part of the establishment and shilling for the government. I mean, can you, like, you cannot write this stuff. I don't know what happened.
Well, even Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam, one of my favorites, and Corey Taylor, just don't talk about it. It's not your area. You're so good in so many other things. You're so talented. That's why we pay tons of money for your merchandise and to visit your concerts and sing along. But then they just act like they know about things that have taken decades for people to study, and they still can't grasp them. So yeah, I mean, but Pearl Jam and Nirvana are my favorite 90s bands. But yeah, to see Slipknot do the same thing,
oh,
that's certainly devastating. Yeah,
oh,
well, it was Corey Taylor in one of his like sing-alongs that he does, where it's just him and the crowd, and of course he gets into politics, and I go, dude, it's such a losing battle. You can hear the crowd booing and everything. So yes, but very disappointing.
And, you know, I don't mind people talking about their political value. This is where I actually differ from a lot of people. I want people to tell me what their political values are, because that means, yeah, I know whether or not you are authentically living whatever image you're putting out, or you are not authentically living whatever image you're putting out. And so I'm actually glad that people like Rage Against the Machine and Offspring and Slipknot and Eddie Vedder have told us exactly what their political values are, because it means that they were never putting out an authentic image of what they believed in the first place. Again, like, my values have never changed since the 90s. And it seems as though a lot of people who claimed that they were anti-establishment and anti-government and anti all these things were really ready to go when it came to supporting things that aligned with their sensibilities. And so I think it's, you know, one of the reasons that I always thought that I wanted to be a free speech lawyer growing up is I actually idolized when the ACLU would defend the most deplorable possible people. I thought that was amazing. When the ACLU would defend literal members of the KKK or literal Nazis or just some of the most deplorable speech that you can possibly imagine. And I don't agree with the speech of any of those groups at all, but I absolutely agree with their right to say it. And the fact that the ACLU did that in the 90s, it showed you that they were living their values, that this was not about like only protecting speech we agree with. It was about protecting all speech. And it absolutely amazes me, these people that are out front and center that have these huge, massive platforms that will actively tell us we don't actually agree with any of the values that we've expressed over the years. We just were waiting for people to come along that agreed with us. And it's like, that is not the point.
So in taking these ideas and putting them into action, I love the LPMC with all my heart. I'm so thankful for you guys. Now, Originally, it was let's totally ignore them. They're a nothing group. And then it turned into there are some people who, are making the party a little hostile and taking it away from its foundations. And now we have gone into there explicitly being something called the Libertarian Defense Fund, which is set up to oppose the Mises PAC, the Mises Caucus. They call it the Mises PAC. So, excuse me. So I want to go through this Libertarian Defense Fund. Did Sarwark set this up or did he just write the letter?
No, I think he wrote the letter. I think it was set up by the guys in Pennsylvania. And also Will McVeigh seems to be involved as well. And so maybe the guys in like Pennsylvania and Delaware. So I don't know exactly who set it up, but I do think, you know, it has been fast. I've been involved with the Mises Caucus for about a year now, and it has been fascinating to just watch the response as it's slowly starting to dawn on the Nick Sarwark libertarians that they're going to lose in Reno. And, you know, I was at the Pennsylvania convention and it was amazing. I was one of those people who was bussed in, although I wasn't bussed in and I wasn't paid to come. And there was no, like, I keep hearing that Michael Heiss owes me a check for like food and lodging and stuff like that. I have yet to receive any check. But it's just been like amazing to watch what happens as it's slowly dawning on these people that they're going to lose. And the Libertarian Defense Fund is a perfect example of that.
One thing I want you to sort of work into your answers as we go through these is what originally, if you could, we're going to find it almost like in the first paragraph, but what was it about the LP that was so devastatingly horrible? And why was the LPMC created for what purpose? So I want to start going through this. I'm at libertariandefensefund.org. This was the website that Sarwark's letter told me to go to. So that is where I found this. We're looking at the About Us page. Sentence number one, the Libertarian Party was founded in 1971 as an alternative to the two major political parties that had dominated politics for decades. All right, I'm already pissed off. What do you think about this?
I mean, I don't necessarily know that I disagree. I would assume that you found a party because you actually want the party to be successful. I would assume that that would be the impetus for starting the party. Now, of course, the party's not going to be successful when it's first started. You got to build it up. But I think what's been interesting to me about being part of, and I joined the LPNH and the Mises Caucus, I think about a year ago now, it's been like, you know, coming into the Libertarian Party as an outsider, you see very quickly that it is not about winning. It is about a social club. And that's what's been really kind of amazing for me about being involved with the Mises Caucus, because you have this group of people that, you know, they might call us a cult. And I think they literally do call us a cult on this website. But it's not a cult at all. It's just a group of people that are highly focused on winning. And the first step to winning and actually making the Libertarian Party a viable party instead of just that thing you check the box of when you don't like either of the major candidates and you're like, oh, well, I hate the Republicans. I hate the Democrats. I'm going to vote Libertarian this cycle just because. Like, I view the Mises Caucus as, you know, the first step is taking over the Libertarian Party so that it can actually become a viable party that people are excited about voting for the Libertarian candidate.
Yeah, when I hear the word, it was founded as an alternative, that sort of just seems like it was a different position. Like, we're sort of similar to these other people, but we're a possible alternate.
I see what
you're
saying.
As opposed to taking the unapologetic stand, hey, there was a mass murder campaign in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam in 1971, and libertarians who take this biblical principle of thou shalt not murder, yeah, they lie about it. We actually take it seriously. But it's just an alternative. If you wanted something different, sort of, like if you don't like Coke and Pepsi, we're RC Cola. Why? It that doesn't really inspire me at all. It's like listening to Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. It goes on and says, the Libertarian Party has always been and still is the only party defending all of your rights. Do you feel like the LP under Gary Johnson and Joe Jorgensen was defending all of your rights?
No. And again, like I'll say, I literally saw the Black Lives Matter tweet either not long before or not long after I was chased down the street by an angry mob of Black Lives Matter people who were throwing stuff at us, trying to steal our stuff. I was scared to death that I was going to trip and fall and I was going to get the crap kicked out of me when that happened. So no, I don't view people who are defending these people and saying, you know, we support them as defending my rights. All I was doing was standing on a sidewalk that day and I ended up getting chased by an angry mob.
Article goes on. However, the future of this party is in jeopardy. Well, that's good. When something bad is in jeopardy, that means it has the chance to change for the better.
Yes.
The Libertarian Party was structured from the ground up to address the inherent corruption and problems of the major parties. The Libertarian Party's charter was a radical experiment that prioritized openness, inclusiveness, and democracy. Is any of this true?
Well, they don't prioritize inclusiveness, do they? Because we can look at the state of Massachusetts, where they literally kicked 47 people out of their state party for following their own bylaws. So that doesn't actually sound very inclusive to me. We can look at that, like Will McVeigh in Delaware took over the state party, kicked out 2,000 libertarians, and then created a system where he was only going to let his friends back in. Like, that is not very inclusive. So maybe it was once upon a time founded to be an inclusive thing. I can wrap my head around that. But the people who are literally running this website have demonstrated through their own actions that they don't believe in inclusivity at all.
Will McVeigh has managed to become the worst person with the last name McVeigh. That is devastating. The Libertarians Party, a radical experiment in democracy. Is that what they advocated? I don't know many people in the 70s, but when it comes to, you know, certainly people like Harry Brown in the 90s, it was almost explicitly saying democracy doesn't justify a rights confiscation. So when any immoral action is done in the name of democracy, we still have the ability to run it through this system called the self-ownership, voluntary contract, original appropriation sort of logic approach that we have to things. And that makes it not inherently democratic at all. That's like, that's just saying that majority rules and there's power in voting. Am I just being too pissed off at this, and am I looking too much into that?
No, I mean, I don't think you're looking too much into it at all. Just because a group of people votes that they can take my rights away does not actually mean those people get to take my rights away. And so I do not consent to my rights being taken away just because you hold a secret meeting that you give people 5 minutes notice of on Discord, Will McVeigh. I don't consent. And, you know, I mean, like, one of the interesting things to me, and again, like, I'm still relatively new. It's so interesting to have having been a part of, like, three different political cultures within this like a short time period, because the Democrats and the Republicans and the Libertarians have very different cultures. One of the things that you hear about in libertarian circles that you don't hear about anywhere else is that they don't like democracy. They don't buy into the concept, whereas the two major parties do. So no, I think you're right on board.
And it's not totally different from the other parties. If you and I tried to have a democratic vote to try and take someone's property or initiate aggression against peaceful people, they'd recognize it as wrong in almost every situation, except when a group called government is involved. So, but we really do have a lot of overlap. It's just this double standard that the other parties have. The article continues. It centralized power at the bottom with the members and delegates rather than the top. The Libertarian Party deliberately has weak officer positions, and it's very difficult to remove anyone from the membership. Our founders wanted to make sure every libertarian was heard.
Well, gee, to me, that kind of seems to sound like the party belongs to those who show up. That's what that sounds like to me. Isn't that what that sounds like to you?
Yeah, and for those who don't know, that's exactly what Sarwark was telling Dave Smith that he had to do. He goes, look, you guys are complaining. You don't like what I do. Well, the party belongs to those who show up. And then they started showing up, and now he's starting the Libertarian Defense Fund.
And even in the letter that was sent out, he literally says, it is a lot more difficult to get people to actually run the party than it is to get a few warm bodies to show up for a weekend convention. Nick? You're changing your standards, my friend. And by the way, I'm in New Hampshire. Nick Sarwak's in New Hampshire. If it was so easy to get warm bodies to show up to the state convention, then why at our state convention could Nick and Valerie Sarwak being an at-large member of the LNC, why was it that neither of them could muster enough votes to even get put on the alternate delegate list? They got 5 votes. I got like, what, like 60 some odd votes to become a delegate? Nick Sarwak couldn't even get 5 votes. Valerie Sarwak couldn't even get 5 votes. But it's so easy just to get warm body to show up at a convention.
Oh, and then Nick thinks it's funny that he lost to none of the above when he was what, treasurer or something. I mean, I don't. Oh, and he's like laughing about it, saying, okay, you know what? I'll just go help other people become successful. I go, do you not understand that we hate you? Like, he's like the boyfriend who you're so miserable with, who you just want to say, wow, you are so delusional. Don't you get that I'd almost rather die than be associated with you? How do I explain this to you? That's how bad you are. And he thinks like, oh, what, we're really losing out here.
And well, and I'll tell you this. So what got my attention about the Mises Caucus was actually when Nick Sarwark was noted, because I was working in New Hampshire on this anti-CRT bill. And so all of a sudden, when the Libertarian Convention happened last year, people like state representatives started messaging me saying, Carlin, did you hear what happened with Nick Sarwark at the LP convention? And so what I heard at the time is Nick was so pissed that he got noted that he and his little entourage stormed out of the convention. So if he's saying that he just like laughing about it now, that's not what happened at the time. I'm sorry. No.
What was our strength? Oh my God. What
Oh,
was our This is part of the article. What was our strength for 50 years is now being exploited as a weakness. You've had strength for 50 years,
yeah,
really? And
exactly.
why is it that not everyone should know what the non-aggression principle is? And voluntary contract, and what the state is. If you have strength and you've had it for 50 years as the third biggest political party in one of the most powerful countries on planet Earth, literally everyone, just like they know the sky is blue and they know Jeff Bezos is the CEO of Amazon, a lot of people, that should sort of be backhand knowledge, the non-aggression principle. I mean, what do you
I
say?
mean,
What do you, well, I don't know how to respond to this statement without belittling whoever wrote it.
listen, if the Libertarian Party was so strong, then we would have seen an unbelievably large showing in 2016 when the two main choices were both people that everyone hated. Like, even among the
Yes, yeah.
Republicans, most of them were not bought into Donald Trump. Like, they voted for him because they vote for everyone with an R next to their name. But like, most of the people that voted for him were not bought into him. They liked him after he was in office and they liked some of the things that he did. But like, almost everyone universally hated Hillary Clinton and hated Donald Trump. So if there was a year for the Libertarian Party to show that they could be an actual viable third party, if they were really this strong party, and wasn't Nick Sarwark running the Libertarian Party when all this was going on? If there was a year to show the strength of the Libertarian Party, it was 2016. Now, I'm not saying there wasn't a fair showing for Gary Johnson in 2016, but let's just be honest. If the Libertarian Party was really all that strong, there would have been a massive turnout, and that would have led to them being in the debates in 2020, and that didn't happen.
Look, and the worst part is that it's not like I asked Sarwark about this. I was able to get him alone in person, and I just cornered him. I said, "Dude, come on. Can we admit th this way? We know what's good and what's bad, and we can at least admit there was a problem with Gary Johnson." And he just looks at me. This was in Scottsdale, Arizona, at a meeting called ARG, Anderson Reed Group, which Rothbard spoke at like 2 decades ago. Or probably three. And he goes, look, if doubling the vote turnout is not something you guys can appreciate, I don't know what you will. And I said, well, here's an example. And he starts like walking away from me. And I said, so let's take the worst example of him not knowing what Aleppo is. Now, to be honest, at that time, I might have slipped up. Then again, I wasn't running for president, getting interviewed on these channels. But even if he said, oh, Syria, I'm sorry, I was my brain was somewhere else. Barack Obama has called explicitly for regime change to Bashar al-Assad's administration, and in doing so, the U.S. has armed Jabhat al-Nusra and al-Qaeda in Syria, the people who we claim did 9/11. This president needs to be impeached immediately. Why didn't he say anything like that? He could have said something that's so easy that Scott Horton would have texted to him at any point, but no. But
No.
no, they didn't use any of their power. Now, when it comes to the Mises Caucus, they have all the energy in the world. They have no energy to call out the fact that NATO lied in 1991 about expanding after the Warsaw Pact disbanded. They have no issues with Zelensky banning 11 political parties. They have no issue with the neocons like David Frum and Bill Kristol, but he has all the hatred in the world for the LPMC.
It truly is amazing to me. And again, as someone who was surrounded by people with Trump derangement syndrome in 2020, like it is extremely similar to what happened with that whole thing. And I just think it's fascinating to watch these two phenomenons. I mean, political derangement syndrome is not actually a new thing. It didn't actually start with Donald Trump. And that's why it can impact anyone in any party. And so to watch these people in the Libertarian Party just absolutely lose their mind because they're losing power, it really is quite fascinating. And it just goes back to what I said about my book earlier with critical race theory is not about race. It's only about power. Nick Sarwalk and company right now are acting in exactly the same way woke leftists act. The behavior is precisely the same. Everything, and they even use the same language. They call us all Nazis. They call us all racist. I have been called an anti-Semite, up, down, left, right, here, back. You know, like they call us all the same names. They act exactly like the woke left. And, you know, there's a reason for that.
Oh, yeah. I was called an anti-Semite. And then I tweeted a picture of my bar mitzvah certificate that I got in 2008 after attending Temple Emmanuel in Arizona for 10 years. And I just got blocked. Of course, it's just a constant slander. I want to get through this. It's a little longer. A political action committee known as the Mises PAC, a.k.a. Mises Caucus, is attempting to take control of the Libertarian Party by means of convention packing. They are busing people to Libertarian conventions, telling them how to vote, and seizing control of state Libertarian parties by installing puppet officers. We have lost almost 14 state affiliates so far.
So in New Hampshire, our convention this year took place in the middle of a blizzard, and I can assure you that I was actually not bused there. My husband drove me to the convention, or people drove themselves to the convention. We sat around, we had a bunch of beers all day. It was really great. There was no coup though. Like, I mean, people forget that because of, you know, the New Hampshire Libertarian Party did actually flip this year. It wasn't entirely Mises last year. And then what happened is, you know, Giletta colluded with Joe Bishop henchman and, you know, a mystery person who might be have just written a letter from the Libertarian Defense Fund. Like, they colluded to take over our party. They're literally the ones staging the coups. And again, I was in Pennsylvania. No bus brought me down. No one paid for my lodging. We rented an Airbnb. It was fine. But this is, they're literally making this up. This is fantasy. This is not real.
Even if they were, isn't this people getting involved? He wants Bill Weld in the party so bad, but he doesn't want the Mises Caucus, who has been the best on the Yemen war. They've been the best on the Russian war. I mean, there was a Scott quoted a tweet from LPNH where they were like, how is it that Anthony Blinken still hasn't made a phone call to Sergey Lavrov? And I go, that is so someone we need to be calling the shots for the official LP account, assuming we can't get Malice or anything, even though he's put the offer out there.
Someday.
It's so unappreciative. I mean, this guy is just the worst. The Mises PAC is not a democratically run organization. That's a whole sentence, by the way. He doesn't even care to, he doesn't even care to explain why not being democratic is terrible. Now, did they start this fund just because they wanted to, or did they first take a vote among Americans if the Libertarian Defense Fund should exist? Because that doesn't sound democratic. I don't think Sarwark ever got my permission to start running. We should take a vote on whether or not he has a right to run.
Anti-democratic
is nothing.
I'm literally going to tweet right now, the Libertarian Defense Fund is not a democratically run organization.
when did you and I get a chance to vote on this? This is anti-democratic. We didn't even vote on this about page. Oh, this is very devastating.
Man.
Its members cannot vote on leadership, organization, or activities of the PAC. They just pay dues and follow orders. Ugh. Could you imagine if he had... I'm sorry, I don't know who wrote this, but imagine if these people had that, the smallest amount of courage What organization does that sound like? It cannot vote on leadership, organization, or activities. They just pay dues and follow orders. Well, certainly the police and military, who have taken oaths to initiate violence against peaceful people. Can I find the LP National talking about how you don't have an excuse just because you're following orders? No, they're so brave to call out Michael Heiss. But, you know, Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, the police, the military, the banks, got to kind of let those people go.
I mean, well, and I'll say this, too. I mean, listen, I would say that the Libertarian Party right now is an organization that I just pay dues to, and they don't listen to me at all. Like, in fact, they like to make this big deal about how donors are just leaving the party and fundraising is going down. I have now offered on multiple different occasions to donate $20,000 to the Libertarian National Party if Nick Sarwak and Valerie Sarwak renounce their lifetime memberships and leave the party. And not one single person from the Libertarian Party has reached out to me to even have a conversation, even to say, you know, Carlin, we're not going to force people to leave the party, but is there something else you want, or is there something else we can do, or is this another way we can structure your gift? For me, if someone is offering to give me $20,000, I would probably at least reach out to that person and have a conversation to try to, like, I understand I'm making an unreasonable demand because it's kind of funny, to be honest, but like, they could at least try. They haven't even done that.
The Mises PAC's chairman cannot be removed from office by the membership, which has the effect of making him chairman for life, an absolute king, so to speak. If the Mises PAC is successful in taking over the Libertarian Party, the entire party will be directly under the control of one man, the Mises PAC's chairman.
That's just not true.
It's almost as bad as the Vladimir Putin fear-mongering that we've gotten from 2016. We're just, oh, if Trump wins, oh, it's going to be absolutely terrible. If we repeal net neutrality, oh, it's going to be so bad. I've fallen for this sham too many times.
No, I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Listen, no one is forcing anyone to be a part of the Mises Caucus. If they don't want to be a part of the Mises Caucus, they don't have to.
We believe that power consolidation and unilateral political control are antithetical to the principles of libertarianism. No one man should have complete control over our political party. We believe every libertarian should have a say in how our party is run.
And they can have a say. They can have a say. But in order to have a say, they need to show up to convention and vote. Like, that is the way things currently work. And a lot of these people are just refusing to even take part in the process. They don't come to events. They don't show up to convention. All they do is sit on Facebook all day and complain in the various Facebook groups. Like, that's all they do. So if they want to say in how the party is run, listen, again, like in New Hampshire, we have proactively reached out to people who are not part of the Mises Caucus to be like, come to convention, come to some of our events. Let's sit down and have a conversation. They won't do it. And we can't force them to do it. It's their choice.
One of my favorite things at the Arizona LP convention was talking to people the night before who were sort of like, oh, okay, we're going to meet the Mises people tomorrow. Well, Dave Smith's not going to be there, is he? Yeah, Dave is going to be there. Oh my God. I hope that I don't have to run into that guy. And it was so funny just to see that this was the night before they were just giving, like, you know, finger food and stuff. And then the next day I'm like, are one of these people going to like start something with the caucus, or is one of them going to, you know, try and, you know, intimidate Dave or something? And of course, Dave is shaking hands and laughing with all of them by like noon the next day. I mean, it was so funny to see how you just saw this go from their perception of what this thing's like to actually seeing it and being like, you know, I wish Dave wouldn't say what he says on Legion of Skanks, but at the same time, this is a good guy talking about the most important issues on the planet. So maybe he's not my enemy at all. That's why those conventions, I think, are so important.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree.
The Mises PAC's actions are without question a hostile takeover. Our political party, built for egalitarian participation, isn't designed to withstand hostile takeover tactics. We are vulnerable, and there is a very real threat that we will lose control of our political party within the next 1 to 3 years. Finally, the LP has existed for 50 years, and the Libertarian Defense Fund is here to make sure the Libertarian Party survives another 50 years. We are our party's first, last, and only line of defense against hostile takeovers.
Well,
final
thoughts. You know what's funny is I really did tweet the Libertarian Defense Fund is not a democratically run organization while we were talking, and they responded immediately, and they said, we just had our elections. Sorry to inform you, but you didn't win. So you're telling me that the Libertarian Defense Fund belongs to those who show up. So maybe next year we should all just join the Libertarian Defense Fund and show up to their elections and we take over that. I mean, like they're literally doing the things that they don't want us to be doing. And you know what? I'm sorry, but too little too late. They should have, I can respect people who say, you know what, this is an organization that I'm a part of. This is a culture that I'm a part of. I want to stay the same. Now, I don't agree with them. I think that the Mises Caucus is desperately needed in the Libertarian Party, but I can respect that effort, right? But when they're literally using the same tactics that the Mises Caucus use, except that they're doing it at the last minute when they're not going to be able to be successful and it's just too little too late. I'm sorry, you got outplayed. You got outplayed, Libertarian Defense Fund. It's just the way it is.
So they then list 5 steps of what we, the LP Defense Fund, can do. 1, court packing. To keep the Mises PAC from taking control of state affiliates, we engage in convention counterpacking. We recruit new members, reach out to old members, and advertise your state's convention and generally make sure Mises will be outnumbered at conventions.
Rules for thee, but not for me. That's what that reads like.
Candidate recruitment, step 2. It's impossible to defeat a hostile takeover without having candidates opposite Mises on the ballot. This is why I think Sarwark wrote it, because he said this to me. I said, what comes to mind when you think of Tom Woods? I'm waiting for hero, guy who is great at explaining the message for freedom. He goes, podcaster. I said, how about Ron Paul? He goes, opposite Bernie Sanders. And I go, what a weird way to say it. And then I read this and I go, oh, here we have Sarwark at work. We recruit candidates for inter-party offices to make sure that Mises always has opposition. Not that morality is achieved. Not that a consistent philosophy is communicated to Americans. It's just to make sure Mises always has opposition. Always. We never get this black and white commentary when it comes to NATO. Murder campaigns in Afghanistan or invading Iraq. But when it comes to the LPMC, we always have to oppose them.
Well, and you know what? It's their right to do it, and more power to them if they want to run candidates. But then what they have to do is make sure those candidates actually appeal to people and win. The fact of the matter is the Mises Caucus is running candidates that appeal to people, and that's why they win. If they want to try to do it, more power to them. I just don't think they're going to be successful.
Step 3 out of 5. Almost done here, Garland. Thank you for staying with me.
Yeah.
Bylaws hardening. We identify and address the inherent flaws in each state affiliate's bylaws that could make them susceptible to hostile takeovers. We then attempt to fix these weaknesses via bylaws changes.
That is possibly one of the most insidious things they're talking about, because they're talking about doing what Will McVeigh did in Delaware, which is to kick everyone out of the party that they don't like. I mean, and that is, again, the very opposite of inclusion.
Step 4. Oh. Okay. I wonder if a lawyer came up with this idea.
Uh-huh.
Step 4, lawsuits. Occasionally, a state party becomes fractured by a hostile takeover attempt, and there is a dispute as to who the rightful executive committee and or board directors is. If necessary, the Libertarian Defense Fund will file lawsuits to settle disputes as to who is actually entitled to represent the party.
I mean, it seems to me that there's already a process in place for determining these things. But the problem is, of course, is as we saw with the JC decision regarding Delaware, it didn't go their way. So they didn't like it. And it's going to do the exact same thing in Massachusetts. There's already a system in place to accomplish these same things.
You know, it just seems exactly like the Jeletta Jarvis, Joe Bishop henchman move. Where, I mean, it's just so bad. For so long, we just said, it's so odd. We just don't see eye to eye with these people who are our ideological brothers. And then they go and do something like that. And it's like, thank you for letting us know that you're just bad people. And it's not that we see things differently.
And did you know there was kind of like a second soft coup attempt in New Hampshire that Daryl Perry started? Before our state convention even, Daryl Perry got like 13 signers on a letter to hold a separate state convention. So they didn't even bother to come to our official state convention. They were organizing a separate state convention to elect like the real Libertarian Party of New Hampshire delegates for Reno. Do you know who was one of the signers on that letter? Jaletta Jarvis.
You see, it's really bad when people take an unscheduled tour of the White House on January 6th. We're going to call that a coup, but forcibly changing democratically elected votes. Well, that's not a coup at all. That's just making sure a hostile takeover doesn't occur.
Isn't that funny?
Post-Mises affiliate management, the fifth and final step of the defense fund plan. Once a takeover has been defeated and a state affiliate has been returned to members of the Libertarian Party, we then focus on keeping Mises out permanently. We employ tactics to make sure they do not gain a foothold in that state ever again.
Well, it doesn't seem to me like Nick Starwalk actually believes the party belongs to those who show up when he's actively creating barriers to prevent people he doesn't like from showing up. That is not inclusive. Like, I'm sorry, like, the social club stuff has got to stop, and it will stop. And, you know, part of me is like, what are we all going to do when this drama is over in May and we can actually focus on fighting the state and doing the things that we want to be doing? But it's just like, stuff like this shows us why all of this is necessary. It is necessary so that we can actually be a functional party.
I mean, again, we have this black and white sort of unapologetic statement, keeping Mises out permanently, not making sure members realign with the non-aggression principle or the peace principle or the non-aggression obligation, whatever you want to call it. It's focusing on one group specifically. And I never hear this unapologetic blanket statement about the state and their kidnapping of people for victimless crimes, their regulations, which stop people from climbing the ladder out of poverty. It's only when someone like Michael Heiss dares to do exactly what Starwalk had been telling them to do, which is, well, show up to the convention if you like it so much.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, again, critical race theory is not about race. It's about power. The Libertarian Defense Fund is not about libertarianism. It is about protecting a social club. That's all that it is. It is about a social club.
I want to end with you giving me your elevator pitch to the left and your elevator pitch to the right. Why should those people embrace the philosophy of libertarianism? Let's start with the right. What do you say to them?
I would say for people on the political right, you know, I spent all 2020 spending a lot of time around conservatives and Republicans and MAGA people, and those are not necessarily the same group. Those are all very different groups. And one of the things that I heard in common among all of those people is that they just wanted their individual liberties to be protected. They just wanted to be able to live their lives and do what they want to do and worship how they want to worship and have their job and have their home and have their family. And what I would say to those people is the Republican Party is not serving you. The Republican Party does not defend you. The Republican Party, your politicians, most of the time will throw you under the bus without giving it a second thought. And so if you legitimately want to be a part of a party that will just allow you to live your life the way that you see fit, that will protect your children from being indoctrinated in government-run schools, because this is something that the Libertarian Party does support, defunding the government schools to provide these additional options so that you can actually school your kids in the way that you feel most comfortable, if you want your speech protected, if you want to be able to worship however you want to worship without interference from the state, this is the party for you. It is not the Republican Party. They are not going to defend you.
And let's just say you don't think the LP can win. In a lot of states, the election between Democrats and Republicans are very close. Like in Arizona, it's a total purple state. So what you could do is use the LP as leverage against potential Republicans. Hey, look, Thomas Massie, if you don't come out with a deregulation of, there was a guy, Elvis Summers, in California, who made tiny houses for the homeless for $1,200. This was going to solve homelessness in Los Angeles, by the way, out of all the places. It's not like, well, he did it in the Hamptons. He did this in Los Angeles, where there's this huge homeless issue. And the state confiscated all the property, even though it was on private land, because it wasn't up to code with what they thought a house should be. So the homeless people continued to be homeless. But don't worry, they were working on a plan as of the early 2010s to solve poverty. That was their excuse. So when you have something like that, you can say, hey, Thomas Massie, if you don't share this and you don't start saying we need to deregulate all capitalist acts between consenting adults, we're going to run someone against you. I mean, use some leverage. I don't know. I haven't thought too much about it. But I mean, can we do something like that? Can we move people like Ted Cruz or Lindsey Graham? Oh my God, please.
I absolutely think we can move people like that. And to be quite frank, if things play out like I want them to play out, which is that the Mises caucus takeover is successful in 2022, Dave Smith runs for president in 2024, I firmly believe that Dave Smith will be a spoiler for the Republicans in 2024. I absolutely believe it. And I think at that point, there is opportunity to try to leverage that to make the Republicans try to actually, like, there have been a lot of conservatives online that have been pushing this idea that, you know, conservatives are not libertarians. Libertarians don't belong here. Well, guess what? You ain't gonna win without us. That is the thing. And so, you know, I absolutely think there's opportunity to try to leverage successful campaigns, not success in terms of like we're going to win the election, but success in terms of we can pull enough votes away from you and so that you lose. And we know it. And if we can't come to some agreement that you're going to implement some libertarian ideas, then we're absolutely fine with you losing. You know, it's not the ideal situation. Of course, the ideal situation is that we want libertarian candidates to win and do libertarian things. But sometimes you just got to take what you can get in the meantime. And a little movement is better than no movement at all.
Exactly. I think Green had a great tweet when she said that we Republicans can lose because the libertarians are voting libertarian. And then in the thread, she said, so we need to start talking to these people and appealing to them. So look, that's all great stuff. I just want to share this one real quick, just because this is so, it really brings into reality how terrible the situation is when it comes to real world situations.
Oh God. Oh no.
This
oh, no.
LA, I know it's reason your favorite. However, the story is legitimate. This is from 2016. LA musician built a $1,200 tiny houses for the homeless. Elvis Summers crowdfunded $100,000 to build dozens of tiny houses. So again, this is early stages. Just like early cell phones were extraordinarily expensive and early computers were, and then they got the manufacturing process down to where they're much cheaper and affordable for more. So $1,200 was the starting price at the earliest beginnings of this operation. City officials looking to pass a $2 billion housing plan tried to shut him down, and sadly, they succeeded. I just had it highlighted. In February, the city council responded by amending a sweeps ordinance to allow the tiny houses to be seized without prior notice. That is what we're up against.
That's evil.
It literally was a plan to house the homeless cheaper than any government official had ever thought of. What are we at? $2 trillion for the war on poverty every year? Or it's about $1 trillion a year in entitlements. And this guy was solving the issue, just like we could solve it in the medical care if they deregulate that and they wouldn't give it. That's why it's so important. We call on people like Massie and I don't even know. Do you call on the Lindsey Grahams of the world? You at least threaten them to lose their position. I'm sorry. Threaten to get their votes taken away to lose their position. Let the record show. I mean, I have nothing but respect for Lindsey Graham.
Yes, we do not do violence. But, you know, I think it's more effective on the state level. I mean, this is absolutely something that has been done in New Hampshire. Obviously, we have a lot of Republicans in our New Hampshire State House that are, they're libertarians, but they're registered as Republicans in order to get elected. But a lot of them are free staters. And this has absolutely been done where, we have to be strategic about where we put our resources. Obviously, right now in New Hampshire, we have one big race that we're focused on for libertarians. That's Jeremy Kaufman is running for the United States Senate. I technically am nominated for governor, but we've made a strategic decision that we are putting our resources behind Jeremy Kaufman, to be quite frank, because we can't beat Chris Sununu for governor. We can't. And so we have to be strategic about these things. We have to be strategic about what candidates we support on the state level. We have to be strategic about what candidates we support for Congress. And so in those races where we maybe just don't have the resources or the money or the people or whatever to do a full-fledged like election campaign, we can at least try to negotiate. We can at least try to leverage something. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think this is just about being strategic. It's not about not wanting libertarian candidates to win. Of course, we want them to win, but you can only win so many races, and sometimes you have to finagle things a little bit.
What is your elevator pitch to leftists or progressives who should embrace the concepts of libertarianism?
I would say to leftists and progressives, the reason that you should embrace the comment, the direction of libertarianism is that your own government has betrayed you over the past 2 years. Your own government has masked your children. Your own government has created irreparable learning loss for 2 years. Your own government told you that you couldn't go to work, that you couldn't, they tried to censor you even asking questions about what was in the medicine they all wanted us to take. And listen, I say that as someone who's vaccinated. I got vaccinated because I wanted to go to London. It's a stupid idea, but like, whatever. I say that as someone who's vaccinated. Like, I think that, you know, the number one thing that I've seen really bother people on the political left is A, this idea of censorship, that the Democratic Party is pushing tech censorship on across the political spectrum. They are absolutely censoring people on the left. They're a very far progressive leftists that are being censored by the big tech companies just as much as there are people on the right being censored. So when the government pushes censorship, they're not just censoring people that you disagree with. They're going to come for you too eventually. And they've been coming for more and more people on the left. And so if you want to continue to support government authoritarianism, do not be surprised when they come for you. A libertarian party only becomes viable when people believe that it can be viable and people put their votes in that direction. And I'm sorry, when our choices are between Democrats who want to control us and Republicans who also want to control us, there is no other viable option if you actually want to create a society in which you are free to say what you want to say, think what you want to think, do what you want to do. As long as you're not hurting other people or stealing their stuff, you have a home here, and your party has probably changed more than you think it has.
And one final one. The same thing happened in Washington, D.C. This article is titled, Jay Austin's Beautiful, Illegal, Tiny Houses. This was in August. But tiny houses come with one enormous catch. They're illegal. In violation of several codes in Washington, D.C.'s zoning ordinance, among the many requirements in the 34 chapters and 600 pages of code are mandates defining minimum lot size, room sizes, hallway widths, and accessory dwelling units that prevent tiny houses from being anything more than a part-time residence. So that's what we are up against. That's why I support the LPNH and the Mises Caucus so much. Carlin, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find your work?
Yeah, thank you again for having me, Keith. I've absolutely loved this chat. People can find my work at activelyunwoke.com. I'm working right now. I mean, obviously, my book is available for pre-sale. It comes out on April 26th. You can get the hardcover version. You can get the audio version. You can get the Kindle version. It'll be delivered right to your door. So you can find that on activelyunwoke.com. I'm also right now working on building out a platform that is just a treasure trove of ideas for different ways to fight back against woke leftists, actionable strategies that everyone can use. You can also find me on Twitter at Dr. Carlin B right there somewhere. And I create daily content on my YouTube channel. You can just look up my name, Carlin Borisenko. I do streams at 5 o'clock every day except for Saturdays. And I do clips in between covering news and culture and all sorts of different things.
Thanks to everyone for watching the Don't Tread on Anyone podcast and the Libertarian Institute. Carlin, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thanks again.